Hello, and welcome to the Courtney Turner Radio Hour. We are here on WWCR Worldwide Radio, and this is airing on March 4th, 2024. I can't believe it. So this has been quite a week. I had told you that I would tell you all about my trip back to the state capitol, and we will definitely get into a little bit of that. And we will finish up this series of diving into the history of what they call the American Wundtianization of education, or the Leipzig connection, as I was talking about the last time with Klass and Leone. They wrote a book. It was 155-page book called The Leipzig Connection. So we'll talk a little bit more about that and really just recap on, I highly recommend, America's Seekish Establishment, an introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones. And we're going to focus on the chapter on how the order controls education. But before we do that, I just want to let you know, I will be posting the video version of this. So if you want to follow along with the visuals or do a recap of listening to this, that will be at my website, CourtneyTurner.com. And that's spelled like Courtenay, CourtenayTurner, T-U-R-N-E-R. And you can find all of my episodes there, all the different platforms as well. And you can support the show so that we can keep going, which would be awesome. I greatly appreciate any support. Also, just liking, sharing, subscribing to all my different platforms is really helpful. But we do have ways you can support me directly. You can do a Give, Send, Go. You can buy me a coffee. You can send a snail mail to P.O. Box. It's P.O. Box 680093. Franklin, Tennessee, 37068. I'll repeat that once more for those of you who are listening. It's P.O. Box 680093, Franklin, Tennessee, 37068. And I have Venmo. It's Courtney-Turner. And then I have several products on my website that you can, purchase, and that helps both me, and you can get great products for yourself. So help both of us. Also, I want to tell you about adding to CrowdRank, which is a really awesome news aggregate. So I call it news with views you can use. So it's kind of a social media version of Drudge, only it is not curated by the mainstream media. It is curated by us, those of us who participate. So it's a pretty awesome concept. And we've been working pretty hard at putting up news on there that is not typical stuff that you would necessarily see in the mainstream media. So definitely join in, send me some love there. It's a really fun way to communicate over the current events of the day. So, and you can just scroll down, go to my website. You'll find all the other different products like the sauna, the RNC store, the F-Rock, and Honey Colony, which is my friend Miriam Hinnane. We've done some great shows together. We've got another one coming up soon. Looking forward to that. And we're actually going to do two coming up. So we'll talk some about her products, and you'll get a whole lesson on them because she has created this company from scratch. And it's really awesome, really great products that are natural and good for you. So yeah, so you'll go check all of that out. Again, that is CourtneyTurner.com, CourtenayTurner.com. So I went back to the Capitol last week. I am now learning more about this process, and it is a whole process. So you have to, you have to get permission to be able to testify. There's a whole procedure for that. And I was not aware of how, sound very ignorant saying that, but it's the truth. I just didn't know how this process worked. So I'm learning. And so I was not speaking. I have a friend, Tiffany Boyd, who you've probably seen her on this podcast. And, I had mentioned her in the previous two episodes as well. I just recently did a radio show with her on her show. And she is the founder of Free Your Children organization, which is a ministry. And it is all about education. And she was a public school teacher, and she is now a homeschool teacher. She has five children, and she has grandchildren, and they are all homeschooled. So she is very personally passionate about this issue. She has done incredible deep dive, not only into the history of some of the stuff that I've been talking about, but she really goes through how it's applicable today. She keeps up with all of the current bills and, you know, kind of breaks them down for you. Although what I've learned from my experience in going to the Capitol is that they're very fixated on the quote unquote verbiage. This is, you know, I feel it is personally a ploy. This is a game that they play. You know, they do these caption bills as a stall tactic, and then they, you know, tell you that we don't have the verbiage. Nobody knows the verbiage. And to that, I typically say that it really doesn't matter to me because I reject the premise. I don't like the principle behind what they're doing. So, and that is very much the case with this, you know, issue of school choice. You know, really, I doubt that they're going to have any kind of verbiage wording in this bill that is going to satisfy me, because I understand the agenda behind it. And I think that's very important for people to really understand, because when you know that this is a global agenda, it is coming from a top-down apparatus and it is infiltrating in our local level, because that is the plan. It is to put every child in their own word. This was in the conclusions and recommendations document the Carnegie Foundation put forth. I believe that was in the 30s. I might be wrong on that, but that I talked about that last time. And in that document, they say they want every child but they want every child in a computer. So, you know, that is the goal. The goal is to create a worldwide workforce and to train children to be cogs in a machine in this workforce. So my experience was, it was interesting. I was very frustrated, mostly because I could just see there was just so much corruption and just so much willful ignorance. And they're just really determined to ram this through. And it does seem like they actually even violated their own rules in order to do so. I'm going to show some clips that will explain that in a little bit. But that's really, you could see it. They just were determined to ram this through, which is what they did in this K-12 subcommittee that I witnessed. It was about 2 hours. And as I said, I didn't speak, but my friend Tiffany did, and she gave a great testimony. But they were really just, it didn't sound like they were really interested in listening to much. Interestingly enough, the one who, there was a Representative Todd Warner, who did a phenomenal job. He was the one who, I think, in the first of this series, I had shown a clip of him saying that, I don't know if I had a chance to present this, but I did have video of him saying that he would, we didn't catch this on video, but when I spoke to him, he said that he would do a roll call. But it turns out that, and he may have fully intended to do so, he was wonderful. He definitely, you know, he voted against it, and he really asked some phenomenal questions. But it was actually McKenzie, who is a Democrat, who asked for the roll call, and we'll get to that clip in a minute. And I think that's very interesting, because really they're playing this game. And as I talked about, you know, the Order of Skull and Bones, this is they weaponize the Hegelian dialectic. And so they play this game where it's like, if it's coming from the Republicans, they think it's good. Anything that comes from them, they're good. The Democrats are bad. And so in some ways, I think it was easier for him to, be oppositional, because he wasn't one of the quote unquote Republicans. So he did a fantastic job. I went up to him afterwards and I told him that, you know, he was very polite, very respectful, but he asked difficult questions. He had clearly read it. And of course, as predicted, you know, Kapiki promised that we would have at least 7 days. And of course, you know, most of them, I don't think, had even read the bill. They kept saying how they had less than 24 hours. It was dropped in their lap. And, you know, it's not like they didn't have other bills and other things to do. So I really don't think most of them had a chance to really read it. But McKenzie did. You could tell. I was sitting up front and I could see him, all the highlighting, and he really did, because he asked phenomenal questions. So he was respectful and polite, but he was persistent. He didn't let up, and he asked great questions. So I was mentioning how they broke their own rules. I'm going to show you a little clip that I actually just found this tonight. Friends of ours send it to tonight, so it was relevant. So I'm going to play this clip from Twitter.
The voice in this recording was hatching a plan.
If we can prove, if you don't side with us, you're going to have to lose the election.
What do you hear in this recording?
If you do not vote with us, we want you scared of us. When you quit doing our will, we're going to dispose of you.
What was said might have been lost to the secrecy of politics, but instead, Phil's got the tape.
Our founding fathers are rolling over in their grave.
The origin of school vouchers in Tennessee revealed. News Channel 5 investigates, Monday at 6.
So I don't know who that voice was. I have some speculation, but I really don't know. However, I think that that little clip, which is like 12 seconds, it says, if we can prove that you don't side with us, you're apt to lose the election. It really does sum up what I'm going to show you next, which is a little clip from this hearing that was about 2 hours long. And is a clip from Gary Humble at Tennessee Stand. And he's showing how, I think I have two clips. So the first one, he's showing how it was McKenzie who asked for this roll call. And by the way, they switched the bills. So this amendment was supposed to go on a different bill. And Gary had mentioned that in the clip before. I didn't clip that part in because it's a longer clip and I didn't want to play the whole thing. But you can go find that on Tennessee Stands on any of the social media platforms. But I actually knew this because Tiffany was testifying and they had moved the bill that she was, the amendment that she was testifying to. So we had known that. But you could say that this is all procedural and it's protocol. It just looks like strategy and tactics and stalling to me, honestly. Maybe I'm wrong. But what I did see was it looked like they violated their own rules because we had heard from Richie when we were there that they could bring in, he was actually the one who suggested that we need to get them to agree to doing some sort of a roll call. One of the things he suggested was the roll call. And he said that we need to be able to get the, I remember who he said we needed to get them to say yes, because they could possibly just bring in the speaker and the governor for extra votes. And what they ended up doing was bringing in a pro tem. Now, that seems like, and we'll play this video.
But at first, I'd like to ask for a roll call vote on this.
Noted.
Thank you.
All right. So there's a bunch of stuff going on right now on Twitter, a bunch of things being posted by, what seems to be by many a conservative group called Americans for Prosperity. The same conservative group, by the way, that pays people $20 an hour to knock on doors for Nikki Haley, but whatever. So their sentiment is, oh yeah, school choice passed and it's so great because look at how transparent Republicans wanted to be. We even took a roll call vote and we did all of these great things and school choice passed, yay. And those who are against it should be embarrassed because you lost so bad because the vote was 6-2. All right. I want to explain all of that to you in this quick little Tennessee Stands video. So listen up. As you saw in that clip, the most important thing to point out in terms of the roll call votes is that a Republican did not call for a roll call vote. All right? The roll call vote was called for by Representative Sam McKenzie, the only Democrat sitting on the committee, because God help any Republican that's going to call for a roll call vote against Governor Bill Lee's school choice bill. All right, so number one, that roll call vote was called for by a Democrat. Secondly, the rules require two other members of the committee. It requires a total of three members to force a roll call vote for a bill. Well, there were two other members that also made a motion for that roll call vote. You don't see them on video, unfortunately, but I just happened to be in the room. I will tell you who they are. They are Representative Brian Ritchie and Representative Todd Warner. And interestingly, another interesting point to make, neither one of those representatives voted yes on the bill. So I want to be very clear, because again, there's so much out there that says Tennessee Stands spreads misinformation, but which, if you watch us, that's up to you to determine whether or not you think I'm giving you misinformation. What I am telling you is that groups like Americans for Prosperity put out half-truths in social media, and half-truths that only support their paid position that they take on any issue, in this case, school choice. So important to close the loop on the roll call vote. It was motioned by a Democrat, and not one member of that committee that voted yes motioned to have a roll call vote. Okay, so just that's an important fact in terms of the roll call vote. The next thing to note is that it was said that the vote, that the measure was defeated, or the measure passed, sorry, by a vote of 6-2. Well, let me tell you how that happened. First off, the six yeses, there's an extra yes to the vote that per our Tennessee Constitution should not be there. Take a look at this clip.
Point of order, or just for clarification, I've had a constituent text me since we've been in committee here, and we have a new member sitting on this committee. Could you explain why this member is sitting on this committee, please?
Thank you. The speaker or the speaker pro tem is allowed to sit in on a committee to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
President McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way I understand it, that the speaker gets a seat on all these committees, not the speaker and the speaker pro tem.
Or his designee.
I like that.
I believe it is
legal.
The speaker or the speaker designee is what we're being told.
So, yeah. So that it's interesting there that, you know, the two people he said who did not vote yes on it. One of them was Warner, who had said that he would do a roll call. And then Richie, who suggested when we were there that we should request that there be a roll call, request that. But it was Richie who was present. And then there was another one. It was Representative Hurt, who was also present, which is basically abstaining from voting. Warner did vote no on this. He's not in favor of this school choice bill. But that's interesting to note. And then the next clip is really about, because it does seem like this tactic was an intimidation tactic. You know, would they have all voted? Would it have been the same split if you know, they hadn't had, you'll see in this next clip where Lambert seems to be going around talking to them. And it's very interesting because we did talk to Representative Hurt afterwards, and I have some footage of that. Unfortunately, we didn't get him from the very beginning because it did seem like once, you know, the conversation got going, things did change a little bit. And that was definitely interesting to see. But I think they were intimidated. And I think this, the point of the fact that the Democrat was the one who called for the roll call was also very significant when you look into the history, because it is dialectical, as we talked last week. And I just think that is so important for people to really understand how this game is played. But let's play this next clip, and then we'll cap it off with some of the history and
The vote that happened last night in the K-12 subcommittee on school choice is unconstitutional. The speaker pro tem, by no rule that I can find, has the authority, nor does the speaker, to sit in and cast a vote on a subcommittee per the approved rules of the House of the 113th General Assembly. That vote that happened last night should be null and void. And let me just close this out by saying this. Well, it was 6-2, and it would have lost anyway. That's not true. The purpose of the speaker pro tem sitting on the committee was to intimidate the committee. Let me throw up this picture real quick. Now, you wouldn't have seen this on video. I just happened to be there. And so there are a lot of things that are happening behind the scenes that the camera doesn't catch because it's not on a wide shot. And what you're seeing here is two things. One, you're seeing Pat Marsh, the speaker pro tem, all the way to the left, who's sitting and ready to vote in on the committee. But what you're also seeing is leader William Lambert, kind of the guy that's leaned over the shoulder that looks like Sonic the Hedgehog. And he's talking in the ear of Representative Chris Hurt. Now, what this picture doesn't show is he was doing that all across the board, all the way down the committee. But what's he doing? Well, he's whipping votes. I mean, so not only is the Speaker packing the committee for votes, but you also have the Republican majority leader of the House going into the ear of all the members as the hearing has happened, whipping votes for the bill. What do you think? Is this intimidating to someone who might want to vote no on the bill, but knows if they do, they're going to be punished by leadership or by the governor, or one of their bills is going to be killed, or they're not going to get certain funds for re-election? There's a lot of things that are being said back there, and I can't propose to know what's actually being said, but I can make some suggestions. So there were two no votes. There were two present not voting. So those were also no votes. And I would speculate that those two men that simply voted present would have voted no had the Speaker pro tem not been there, because now by the Speaker packing the votes, they know that they don't have the votes to win. And see, this is the problem. This is where the intimidation comes in. It's why the vote should be null and void.
So I happen to agree. I don't know for sure if they can't bring in the pro tem, but it seems like that is the case, that they did violate their own rule. Regardless, what seems pretty evident is that there is clearly an agenda to get this thing through. It was a packed room. And, you know, people typically don't go to these kind of things. It was a little bit later in the day, but, you know, it's a middle of the week, work day, definitely during working hours. And people showed up. And, you know, also keep in mind that people who are homeschooling, that like moms who homeschool, are homeschooling during that time. It's not easy for people to take that time and go. So people were clearly not happy about this bill. And really wanted to have their voices be heard. But they seem really intent on pushing this through and ramming it through, whether, by legitimate means or not. And one has to beg the question, why? What is the goal? What is the purpose? Why are they doing that? And some of the questions put forth were, you know, that I felt like very, very, there was a lot of obfuscation. There was a lot of, not answering the questions, and it seemed like they just kind of kept repeating themselves and repeating the talking points they wanted to get across, which were that homeschoolers were not going to be included, which is not true. It is not true. They are included. That is the whole point, is getting the homeschoolers and the private schoolers. And why is that? Because as we described, this is a Hegelian agenda. It's a Wundtian Hegelian agenda. And for Hegel, the state is absolute, but the state is also fiction. And so if this is from the Order of Skull and Bones, so if the order can manipulate the state, in effect, it becomes the absolute. I think I'm going to dive into some of this because I think that will really help understand and give some of the background, the context. I went through this pretty quickly the last time, but I had a slide up about the Illuminati connection. And I do think that that is really relevant. And it's interesting because in his book, on that section, he doesn't say it here, but then a few pages later, he says in the next book. So I would be very curious if he had intended to do a book, on the connection, if he had started to work on, you know, digging up some of those connections and creating a book with that hypothesis. I obviously don't know, but that's something I would love to look into and see if he left any kind of, notes that allude to that. But he does say that he thinks that more research does need to be done. So we can go through, there were some very specific connections, but before I outline that, I wanted to talk about some of the goals of the Illuminati and some quotes from Adam Weishaupt. Let's see if I can find them that I think are, kind of set the tone and really do show that this agenda comes. I think it precedes the Illuminati, obviously, but just to see where some of the connection might be. Let me see if I can find this quote. Okay, so it's a quote from this is the quote from Anthony Sutton, but there's a very similar one in the Dr. Emmanuel M. Josephon's book, and I'm going to read both of them to you. So Adam Weishaupt, we must win the common people in every corner. This will be obtained chiefly by means of the schools and by open hearty behavior, show, condescendence, popularity, and toleration of their prejudices, which we shall at leisure root out and dispel. And then he goes on to talk about Robeson's proof of a conspiracy. And he says that they demand what has brought him to his most desirable of all connections of all conditions. And he answers, society, the state, submissiveness, and false religion. And interestingly enough, the Illuminati was discovered. It was a secret society, much like the Order of Skull and Bones was a secret society. And the reason we know anything at all about it is because the guy who was carrying the papers, when it got shut down, he was carrying, the papers about the Illuminati. Then the Bavarian police got them when he was killed. And, so I guess it's kind of similar with the Order of Skull and Bones. I outlined the trio before, but it was Daniel Coit Gilman, who was very instrumental. He was one of the forerunners, and his responsibility was to set up the trust for the Order of Skull and Bone. It was the Russell Trust, because the order was founded by William Russell and Alfonso Taft. And Alfonso Taft is a relative of President Taft. And it was Gilman's job to set up this this trust, which of course didn't have a whole lot of information, but we did get leaks later, as I had talked last time about Charlotte Isherbit. Her father and her grandfather were Skull and Bones, and she had access to the book that she then gave to Anthony Sutton. So we have the little black book with all the names, people like the Bushes who were in it, which we know from the infamous, Carrie Bush, who were both members of Skull and Bone. And Bush Jr. was known as Temporary. I'd love to know what they meant by that and why they called him Temporary. It's called Roosevelt's Communist Manifesto. So I have talked about how Karl Marx was really, many people see him as a plagiarist. And the Communist Manifesto, there seems to be much evidence to indicate that it really came out of a combination of Clinton Roosevelt's book, The Science of Government Founded on Natural Law. That was in 1841. And Clinton Roosevelt was related to President Roosevelt. And a combination of that and Adam Weishaupt's Illuminati Manifesto. And there's a lot of evidence to indicate that it was really plagiarized from a combination of the two. We do know that the Illuminati, when it was technically shut down, went underground, then there was offshoots. There were offshoots like the League of the Outlaws, which then became the League of the Just, who I kind of think of as the predecessors to today's modern social justice warriors. You could translate it the League of Just Men, and that was helmed by Marx and Engels. And then from there was the Communist League, and Engels, of course, helmed that. Interestingly enough, Engels was a linguist, so he definitely understood the power of language and how to manipulate and use language. Engels was very wealthy, and Marx actually didn't have his name on the original. That's my understanding. They did a publicity campaign for Marx and had him commissioned him to write several articles and journals and other works along the similar themes, but then they later put his name on it. So here is a quote from Weishaupt, who studied at Ingolstadt. He was a Jesuit. He modeled the Illuminati after the Jesuit order. That's part of the why there was the secrecy. That's part of why there was the hierarchical structure to the Illuminati. And so he wrote, it's also, so this is in this book, it's very similar, but it says it's also necessary to gain the common people to our order. The great means to that end is to influence in the schools. So this idea of, you know, controlling through education seems like it definitely predates, you know, the order. And I would argue it goes back way, way longer. But interesting to see, because that was Sutton's thesis, that there's probably some sort of a connection. And we'll go through some of the names, because it does seem like there's actual connections in terms of the people involved, their, you know, family history, their lineage. And it does seem like there's a lot of ties to the Illuminati, which would make sense because the belief system seems to be shared. So I'm going to read some of this too. He said he required of his followers that they yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. And remember, I talked about in the last time how there were the left and the right Hegelians, and the left Hegelians were the ones promoting the progressive scientism, and the right were the Prussian roots of militarism, the rise of Nazism. And to the left would be like Karl Marx and Engels, and those. And then on the right, you know, it was more of the Prussian roots. But this, I had talked about the roots of the Prussian model of education and how it came out of the Battle of Jena when they lost it during the Napoleonic Wars. I think it was 1807. They lost this battle because they were critical thinkers, and they said they wanted to eviscerate critical thinking and breed mindless, obedient soldiers. And here we have Weishaupt saying that he wants them to yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. And here is more. He said, so he, in this book, he talks about how in 1904, Rockefeller had written a letter. And this was interesting because Sutton talks about it too. I'll have to find it in Sutton's book. But he talks about how Gates was one of the advisors to the Rockefeller Foundation. And he says that, so the this is a letter in 1904 that John D. Rockefeller and Frederick Gates wrote, and they say that man is most contemptible of all animals because it is the only animal that can be induced to destroy himself. And then this is Weishaupt's quote. And now remember, the Illuminati was originally called the Perfectibilis, and they had this notion that man can somehow, you know, he's flawed and he can perfect himself. This is the idea that man can, it's very much like a Gnostic view that he's essentially going to become God. He can perfect himself. That's literally what the translation was called, the Perfectibilis. And this is, I think, the fundamental worldview difference between people like what the foundings of the United States, where they believe, you know, human nature, man is inherently flawed, but we want to create some sort of a system that hopefully will incentivize the best of man, but that man is inherently flawed, that he is not going to be perfected, quote unquote. So I think that's a fundamental difference between the two. He says, the most admirable thing of all is that the great Protestant and Reformed theologians who belong to our order see in true, genuine mind of the Christian religion. Oh man, what can you not be led to believe? So this is, you know, how they were so deceiving, and they, you know, lure you with your, like in this case, it's with religion, and then they're mocking them for, you know, falling for their traps and being gullible. These people swell in our numbers and fill the treasury, get busy, make folks nibble at our bait, but they do not tell them our secrets. They are not to be admitted, the secret degrees and knowledge of the conspiracy to enslave them, the true purpose of the order. They must be made to believe that low degree that they have reached is the highest. It would be difficult to express more, that this is Dr. Josephon, who says it would be difficult to express more concisely the objectives of Weishaupt's conspiracy in the field of educational propaganda than was done in the above mentioned occasional letter number one of Rockefeller's General Education Board. And I am going to read this too, because I think this is, it kind of really solidifies all of their goals. In our dreams, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and unhampered by traditions, we work our own goodwill upon grateful and responsive rural folk. We shall try not to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, editors, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, who have an ample supply. The task set before ourselves is very simple, as well as very beautiful one, to train these people as we find them to a perfectly ideal life just where they are. So we will organize our children and teach them to do so in a perfect way. The things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way in the homes, in the shops, and on the farm. And, you know, these are all the elements of Weishaupt's conspiracy, which are found here. So he outlines the first of them is philanthropy. Of course, you know, we see this through, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, all of these different, quote unquote, philanthropic entities. Their intent to brainwash and mold, which we heard repeatedly here. The third is the abandonment of tradition, science, and learning. And this is to favor faith because that's an easier tool to manipulate and subvert. The fourth is the dictatorship of objective. Fifth is the intent to regiment peasantry into a caste system. And then he quotes just where they are. The sixth is the intent to reduce national intelligence to the lowest common denominator and to destroy parental influence. Sorry, have we not seen that today? The seventh is contempt of the peasantry who are called our little children by the tyrannic czar, the little white father. Seventh is the element of deceit. I was just talking about that before. And the eighth is the element of subversion and un-Americanism, avowed to intend to overthrow accepted customs and institutions to serve the purposes of the Rockefeller sponsors and to further their plots and schemes. And finally, perfectibilism, the perfecting of human nature, which was Weishaupt's. That was what the order was actually called. The Illuminati was actually called the perfectibilists. Let me see if I can find, there's one more thing in here before we move on to the other. So I thought that was relevant. And so you can see kind of the roots, and it would have been very interesting, I think, to have seen a book from Sutton drawing the connection between the two. And he talks about, I'm trying to find, because he makes a similar, if I can find this one, where he talks about where he talks about the Rockefeller. Oh, here it is. Okay, so this is where he covers the same thing about Frederick Gates and Flexner. So he tells the story. It was in 1912. Frederick Gates of Rockefeller Foundation had lunch with Abraham Flexner of the Carnegie Institution, and Gates says to Flexner, "What would you do if you had $1 million in which to make a start reorganizing medical education in the United States?" And I just think, you know, I think one of the first radio hours I did was actually on Rockefeller medicine and, you know, the Flexner Report of 1910, which is where we got the allopathic medical system, and where they, you know, because the Rockefellers had the petroleum monopoly and they wanted to, fund the petrochemicals. So because they had the monopoly on the petroleum. And so it was the Flexner Report of 1910. And it was, I'm blanking on his name, but who had influenced him to push for this Flexner Report, and also to later to push the Rockefellers to get into psychiatry. This was later. And that was interesting because at the time, nobody really thought psychiatry was going to be a lucrative field or a fruitful field. And Rockefeller at the time actually was not, you know, all that enthused about it. And it was It was someone who worked with the Flexner, who is a vaccinologist. He was actually involved in, immunization. So it was interesting, all the connections there. But what would you do if you had $1 million to start reorganizing medical education in the United States? And this is reported by Fosdick, and this is what happened. He said the bluntness was characteristic of Mr. Gates, but the question about the $1 million was hardly in accord with his usual direct, cautious approach to spending money. Flexner's reply, however, to affect any funds and $1 million or otherwise could most profitably be spent developing the Johns Hopkins Medical School, struck a responsive chord in Gates, whose close friend, already a devoted admirer of Dr. Wilhelm H. Welsh, a dean of the institution. And Welsh was a member of the Order of Skull and Bone. I think also really interesting is, I have mentioned definitely on my show with Dr. Lee Merritt, and I think on a couple of other episodes, we've talked about how, I think it was John Franklin Enders, who was a vaccinologist also. I think he was came up with the measles vaccine, and he was a member of Scroll and Key, which was kind of a sister organization to Skull and Bones, and he got a Nobel Prize. I think that is very interesting as well, definitely worth noting. So I had talked about Daniel Coit Gilman and how he was tasked to create the Russell Trust, and he became trustee of the Russell Trust, and of course Russell was the co-founder along with Alfonso Taft of the Order of Skull and Bones. And during this time, they had then created the Sheffield School, and it was Gilman who was again tasked with this job to create a proposed plan for the complete reorganization of the School of Science connected with Yale College. And this became, they later did, I think, give him a big position there. But it was this was instrumental in helping them to create what led to the Morrill Land Bill. And it was President Lincoln who signed this, but it was a Land Grant College Act. And that donated public lands for state colleges of agricultural sciences. And so it became Cornell University who got a grant. And of course, And then they later made him professor of physical geography at Sheffield in 1863. So I wanted to talk about the Look-Say reading. This was part of a mother's primer, which was a beautiful thing that was created by Gallaudet for deaf children to help them read. And it was implemented by Horace Mann. And interestingly enough, I actually, I grew up right outside New York City. My neighbor who lived across the street from me went to Horace Mann. I actually looked into going to Horace Mann. I did not go to Horace Mann, but I had looked into it. And he was connected to the Order of Skull and Bones. He was connected through Antioch College. And the board of trustees for Antioch were the Tafts. So he was definitely connected to the Order of Skull and Bones, and he brought this mother's primer into general education. And this is largely responsible for the degradation of children reading today, because it was great for the deaf, but doesn't really make any sense for those who can hear and have concept of language. So here's like a little picture of kind of how it works. So I recommend you look into that, the mother's primer. This really does explain a lot of why we have such a decline of reading in the United States. And of course, Gallaudet was and I think the mother's primer was a beautiful thing for the deaf. But he did have Skull and Bones connections. His two sons were members of Skull and Bones. And the method was, of course, adopted at Columbia's Teachers College and Lincoln School, where it was inspired by Dewey's system of education, which was away from learning and towards preparing a child to be a unit in the organic society. Because as we learned last week with Charlotte Isabit, this is all about creating a global citizen. You know, they didn't call it that at those times, but that term is really going to come on the surface, you know, now. But the, back then they said, you know, part of the worldwide workforce, this is part of their agenda back then, and that is what they're vying for now. And this is part of why they're pushing these bills so hard, because it is all part of this agenda. And this goes all the way back. You know, this is hundreds of years. Educational research, it was claimed, demonstrated that reading words are not analyzed into component letter parts, but seen as complete units. Therefore, learning to read should start with complete units. This is antithetical to, you know, things like phonics, which, you know, you get the parts. And when you start with the whole units versus the parts, it eradicates critical thinking skills, because you don't have the foundation and the building blocks to be able to piece things together. So the idea behind something like phonics is that they could sound it out. You could figure out the word. You could read and figure it out. Whereas if you're starting with the whole units, you know, there's nothing to break down and figure out. So this is really, the way he says it, how children are taught to read and why they can't. And here is another picture for those who are watching, for those who are listening. I highly recommend getting his book and you'll see it. But he has these just little lines, and it says the cat sat on the mat, the rocket zoomed into space. And then you see visuals. So again, for somebody who is deaf and doesn't have a concept of language, this makes sense. But for somebody who is hearing, it does not. Now, I personally was, you know, born visually and hearing impaired. I did not get hearing aids until I was almost 6 years old. I learned how to speak by reading lips, and I was reading before the age of two. So I'm very grateful that this was not a method that I was taught. Let's see if we can go back to, I wanted to point out some of the Illuminati connections, and there was, we know that Wilhelm Wundt was largely instrumental. I talked about the Leipzig connection last time, and his grandfather was Christian Karl Casimir Wundt, and he was known as Raphael in the Illuminati. He was very influenced by Herbert, and so they applied the Herbertian principles of to American education. And let me see if I can find this. So here, chief purpose of education for Herbert was to prepare a child to live properly in the social order of which he is an integral part. So we're seeing a common theme here, right? This is not about developing a child's unique individual skills and talents and harnessing their passions and, you know, helping them to be the best that they can be with their unique gifts and talents. This is about putting them into, you know, this global machine where they are a cog. And because for Hegel, there is no freedom outside of serving the state. And I would argue for Weishaupt as well. So this is a common theme amongst all of them. So because the individual is not important, the purpose is to develop character and social morality. And the most important task of education is to analyze the activities and duty of men within society. So essentially what Marx would call socialist man, right? These are the goals. And this is why we are seeing what we are seeing in education. So I did have the outline of the different names last time. It was Johann Gottfried Herder, who was Damascus in the Illuminati, Johann Gottlieb Fichte, who I think I read the quote the last time where he literally says the purpose of education is to eradicate free will. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he says. Then there's, of course, Friedrich Schiller and Johann Wolfgang Goethe. And he was known as Arbarus. And then there was also Pestalozzi. And Pestalozzi was a huge influence on Wundt and Herbert. Well, Herbert, and then, you know, because Wundt was influenced by Herbert. And his name in the Illuminati was, what was his name? Pestalozzi. I don't remember it, but... Alfred. Alfred in the Illuminati. So, yeah, so we can see there's lots of, like, direct connections to all of them. I went through the Leipzig connection quite a bit last time, so I think let's just, I think we only have a few minutes left, so I'm just going to sum this up. And you can, I think I mentioned it last time, but Ficke actually had the idea for the Völkerbund, which was basically the League of Nations. And he said that we should, as this federation spreads further and gradually embraces the whole earth, perpetual peace begins, the only lawful relation among states. And this was from, and then it later was adapted in the National Education Association. There was the program in 1976, bicentennial, entitled The Declaration of Interdependent Education for a Global Community. So that's, so we can just see these common themes that are throughout. So we have some of these, just the goals were to create private and parochial schools to provide an education closer to the common school ideal than public school. Private school students learn more than public school counterparts. Coleman, this is from in 1981, James Coleman, University of Chicago, produced a study of public schools for the National Department of Education. In this study, Coleman's National Opinion Research Center contacted 58,728 sophomores and seniors and 1,016 public parochial and private schools across the United States. These were his findings, sorry. So private and parochial schools provide education closer to the common school ideal than public schools. Private school students learn more than public school counterparts. Coleman wrote that it was a paradoxical that Catholic schools function much closer to American ideal of the common school than do public schools. Private schools provide a safer, more disciplined, and more ordered environment than public schools. And he said that Blacks and Hispanics, this is back in the 80s, perform better at private schools. And so this is why they are going after the homeschoolers and the private schoolers. So now homeschoolers really are in private school in Tennessee. And yeah, let's, I think we'll just wrap it up with Sutton's suggestions for what the solutions should be. He said, if the United States is to survive the coming technologically intensive age, then certain recommendations should follow. And those are the functions of the schools to develop the individual talent. Social engineering as an objective has to be discarded. A thorough grounding of the three R's is essential for a good education. In other words, content is all important. And I'll just add that that is part of why, you know, when they say things like Common Core has been, you know, outlawed, you know, the critical race theory, whatever it is, that they say that it's not legal in this state, you know, it's still embedded through the, you know, the ideology. So the content really is very, very important. And of course, this is part of why the homeschoolers are very concerned about the regulations on testing, because if they have to test and pass tests that have the indoctrination embedded in it, then they have to teach to pass these tests. That's very problematic. So the next solution is that it follows if schools of education should be abolished. This is under serious discussion at Duke University. That has been proposed at University of Michigan, even Cal Berkeley. And this was back when he wrote this book. Teacher credentials should be based on subject matter entirely, not educational theory. All restrictions on private schools should be abolished. That means homeschoolers as well. And public schools should be returned to local control, not government, not, you know, this globalized type of agenda. So I would agree with him on all of those. And that is why I'm really trying to educate people about the roots and the origins of this agenda. And of course, to try and stop it locally if we can. So I apologize. I'm exhausted. This has been a really, really long week. So we did a lot more reading from this, but hopefully this gives you some inspiration to go and do your own research. And if you want to see any more of my work, you know, of course, go to CourtneyTurner.com. We have some really great shows coming out. I did a bunch of really great, really long, awesome episodes this week. So definitely stay tuned for that. Go check it out. CourtneyTurner.com, CourtneyTurner.com. And you can support my work, support the podcast there, give us a go, buy me a coffee, send me a Venmo, or if you find some products that you feel are aligned with you and will help you, then you can get great products for you. And that will help me too. So again, that's CourtneyTurner.com, CourtneyTurner.com. And yeah, you can find me on Mondays at this time on WWCR Worldwide Radio. And I believe I'm going back on Tuesday. So this is going to be on the conservation build, which is interestingly enough, you know, some of the same people, I think it was Lamberth who put that forth, and he calls it agricultural easements. But we know that those are conservation easements. So I will be talking to them, and hopefully we can put a stop to all this madness. Well, thank you so much for tuning in and for listening. And for those who are watching, thank you.
My name is Tiffany Boyd, and I am here today representing Free Your Children and the homeschool community at large. I want to start by saying that we already have school choice in Tennessee. We have the choice to homeschool our children. We have the choice to send them to public school. We have the choice to send them to private school. In the state of Tennessee, the majority of homeschoolers are registered under Category 4 schools, which makes them fall into that private school category. As homeschoolers, we adamantly oppose this bill. At a recent event, a representative promised the public 7 days to review the House language. That did not happen. A game of cat and mouse in an attempt to prevent public comment has failed. Homeschoolers were told they would be written out of the bill. They were not. The public was told the bill would not come with strings. It does. We know and understand that what the government funds, it runs. We know and understand school choice initiatives lead to increased government overreach as witnessed in other states. We know that the state of Tennessee is not adequately educating public school students. Since you have not been successful educating our state's public school students, why then would taxpayers want the state controlling private education? There is no choice when all choices are government controlled. School choice does not create competition. There is no competition when all forms of education are government controlled. School choice expands big government by creating public-private partnerships. Public-private partnerships create a system that is unaccountable to the taxpayer. Public-private partnerships destroy transparency. School choice vouchers are the root of public-private partnerships and are designed to medicalize our schools, effectively destroying our constitutional rights. School choice destroys true private education, our parental rights and educational rights, and our constitutional rights. Research proves that homeschool students statistically outperform public schools. We are not broken. We do not want government money. We want the government out of our homes.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.